Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Some members of Generation X have a nostalgic sweet spot for the mid-90s. It was a time when the latchkey freedom of the 80s still reigned over life online. That's the setting for author Kevin Wilson's captivating novel, Now Is Not the Time to Panic. It's a tale of rural teen friendship, loneliness, and artistic rebellion in an era where you had no clue what was going on beyond the borders of your town. Frankie Budge is an aspiring teenage writer. She's bored with her small town until she meets the talented artist Zeke. Together, they create a suspicious graffiti poster, which creates widespread panic among the quiet town. Kevin joins us now to talk about his novel and admits that there's both a practical reason and an artistic reason for setting it in the 90s.
The practical reason is I just really love writing in the 90s because the technology is not so advanced that it messes up my plot line. You know, cell phones, the internet, that muddles things up for what I wanted to do. Set it in the 90s and you have a little more freedom. But the larger reason and the artistic reason is that I grew up in the 90s, and one of the things I love is that moment right before technology really opens up the world. And for me, living in a rural town in the 90s, there was a kind of isolation, a kind of lack that I think made you get weird if you wanted something that you couldn't have.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you would have to use your own imagination and not rely on technology so much. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, and you also don't really know everything that's out there, so you invent something and you think you're the first person that made it, and that makes you a little weird too, because you feel magical.
Your two protagonists are 16-year-old Frankie Budge and Zeke. How would you describe the relationship between Frankie and Zeke and how it develops?
Well, I think it's that they kind of recognize the loneliness of each other. And, you know, the summers for teenagers is unstructured and unfamiliar. And so in this moment, I think they realize, hey, we can hold on to each other. We can do fun stuff. We can be less alone. And so at first, it's just, it doesn't matter who the other person is. It's that they're not lonely. And then they recognize the weirdness in each other, these desires that extend beyond the world that they live in. And that's what kind of pushes them forward in the story.
Mm-hmm. And something else that pushes them forward in the story is this one day when they decide to collaborate on a poster. How does this happen?
Both of them are artistically inclined, and one of them writes and one of them draws, and they've got this whole summer ahead of them, and Zeke suggests that they collaborate on a project. And so they decide to make a poster where Zeke will provide the art and Frankie will provide the text, and they feel like they can spend the whole summer hanging it up and kind of making themselves known to their tiny little town, and that becomes the artistic project.
Yeah, and can you describe for us what the poster looks like?
So they kind of know that graffiti exists, like they've heard of it, they've seen it, and they think we'll make our own, but we'll copy them in advance so that we don't get caught, right? So we can just put it up and run away. And so Frankie kind of digs down inside of herself. She wants something that's strange, that seems mysterious. And she comes up with this line, "The edge is a shanty town filled with gold seekers. We are fugitives, and the law is skinny with hunger for us." And the moment she does that, Zeke fills in the art, which is kind of dark, mysterious, scratchy outsider art, and now they've made something that they each own.
Mm-hmm. And it is such a beautiful phrase. To my ears, it has kind of a Jack Kerouac spontaneous prose vibe to it. How did you come up with it?
So I didn't come up with it. I mean, that's the thing, is that this is the one element of the story for me that's entirely from my own life, which is, after my freshman year of college, I was rooming with my cousin in an apartment, and his best friend, this guy named Eric Haley, who had gone to NYU film school. He had just finished his MFA in theater at Alabama, and he was working that summer to make money before he moved to LA to become an actor. And we hung out, and I just really liked him. He was super charismatic. We would make little movies. He encouraged me to write. And then the other thing that was happening that summer was I was working for a medical center, and my job was to put the entire 500-page policy and procedure manual up on the internet, which was fairly new at the time. So by hand, I was typing in HTML the entire manual, and I got super bored and decided to just start making stuff up, and I would just write random things in the policies, and nobody ever seemed to notice, so I kept doing it. And one day I asked Eric, I was like, I'm doing this. Do you have a line? And I was like, I'm writing stuff that's slightly apocalyptic, a little strange. And he said, oh, I've got you. And he said that line. And for whatever reason, like you've mentioned, the kind of rhythm of it, it just burned itself into my brain. And I've held on to it ever since.
Yeah. Getting back to Frankie and Zeke, they put up these unsigned posters all around town. Can you tell us how people react to the posters without revealing any spoilers?
I think people get freaked out. In a tiny town, a mysterious poster pops up. You think you know everyone, so you either imagine someone in your town is evil and weird, or strange people have invaded your town. Either way, it's not great. And so it causes more of a panic than they think.
Yeah, and I don't want to give anything away, but yeah, it makes total sense that it would cause a panic, but I don't want to spoil it. Anything else I say about it, if I keep babbling on, I'll give away something. You teach fiction at Sewanee, the University of the South in Tennessee, and you tell your students that writing a novel is like buying a car, and that writing short stories is like stealing a car. How so?
Oh, yeah. That's my little thing that I kind of use to explain to them. I don't know that it lands, but for me, short stories and the way that I've written them is all about kind of forward momentum and then combustion. So I'm always like, for me, the sensation of writing a short story is stealing a car, driving it really fast, crashing it into a tree, and walking away unscathed. It's the thrill of knowing where you're going and knowing what's about to happen that's going to blow up. And then novels for me are buying a car with a really good interest rate on a loan, and you set out and you know that you've got a long way to go, but you also know that if something interests you, you can stop. You can spend time there. You can kind of meander because you always know that you're going to end up in a place that's different.
That really lands with me, and I'm sure you're being modest, and it does, I think, I can imagine. I can't see how it wouldn't land with your students. That's a really great description, great way of describing it. Your debut novel, The Family Fang, was adapted into a movie starring Jason Bateman, Nicole Kidman, and Christopher Walken, and it was directed by Jason Bateman. Are there any plans to adapt your latest novel, Now Is Not the Time to Panic, into a movie?
God, I certainly hope so, because that was such a magical experience. You know, anytime you write something and you get to meet Nicole Kidman, you're like, I would like that to happen again. One of the things I've kind of learned is just how unpredictable the film industry is. You never quite know what's going to happen. I know that it's out there, and I'm hopeful that somebody wants to take a chance on it. And just the idea of seeing it on the big screen is, you know, fascinating, kind of wonderful.
Yeah, and what I'd be really excited about, that if and or when it is turned into a film, adapted into a film, then we would actually get to see the poster that Frankie and Zeke created, wouldn't we? We'd have to get to see it, wouldn't we?
Yeah, I would love that. Yeah, it's so strange. Since the book has come out, I've actually had multiple people send me their idea of what the poster looks like, which has been a little disconcerting, but also just amazing to see it actually in front of me.
You mentioned it's been disconcerting because some of the, can you tell us why?
Well, you spend your entire life writing inside your own head, and you imagine this thing, and it's a private enterprise. And obviously when you send a book out into the world, you want it to connect with people. But then like, there's always that moment where you're like, oh, people have seen this. People have imagined it. People have taken it and done something with it. And you're always like, I hope I did something good here. You know, I hope I've made something that people like, and it comes back in that way. And so far it's been lovely, but you never quite prepared to get to hear the signal come back to you.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense. I want to get back to the film adaptation of your debut novel, The Family Fang. You mentioned that you got to meet Nicole Kidman, and it's worth pointing out, I think, that Nicole Kidman got to meet you, Kevin Wilson. But so you were happy with how the adaptation turned out?
I couldn't have been more happy. I think I totally understand. I'm not like pretending that this is a silly thing, but I know that there are authors who are incredibly protective of their work, you know, that with adaptation, they're very worried. But I love movies and I love adaptation. And one of the things I love about it is that it has to be different from the source material in order to translate to a different medium. And so I find that stuff thrilling. And I always knew, one, I thought it was going to be great because of the people involved and how careful they were. But I also knew that, you know, on the very rare chance that it was awful, I still had my book. That didn't change. So I was all for it. I couldn't wait to see what they did.
Mm. Have you thought about this enough, about the possibility of the current novel, Now Is Not the Time to Panic, being turned into a movie? Have you thought about who you would like to play Frankie and Zeke?
Oh, my God. I am so disconnected from the real world that I don't even know who the actors would be of that age that would fit. Mm. I have them. I think that's the other thing that's slightly weird always about Hollywood is that Frankie and Zeke are strange teenagers who grew up in the 90s and are not beautiful, or at least not beautiful in a traditional way. And that's what's appealing to me about them. And so, you know, that's always your concern, is you don't want to pretty them up. You want them to look like teenagers.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, very well said. I just really related to both Frankie and Zeke. And I think in large part because I was a misfit like them back then. And in many ways, I'd say I still am a misfit, a much older misfit. But they're just such beautifully, beautifully drawn characters. And I understand that Shirley Jackson is your favorite writer. How has she influenced your fiction?
Oh, gosh, in so many ways. I mean, I think the obvious one is just strangeness, of being mm-hmm. open to magic and weirdness and characters who inside of them hold something that they themselves can't quite figure out. And it's a little scary and a little thrilling. I also love, you know, in my work, I generally don't like my characters to ever leave the town or their own house. Like, I just like to keep them in a single space. And Jackson, so much of her work, like her characters either physically or mentally can't even leave their homes. And so I love those kind of stories of what do you do when you're constrained in space. And then the last thing about Jackson that I think doesn't get as much kind of discussion is, you know, she wrote all these essays for women's magazines that were kind of humorous, and they were about raising children. As a parent and someone who helps to raise two boys, I love the idea that Shirley Jackson could write these incredibly dark, very strange novels and then write these somewhat lighthearted, kind of lovely essays about the strangeness of raising children. I love that she could hold both of those identities inside her body, and that resonated with me.
Mm. I'm curious. I want to go back to your comment that earlier, just a few moments ago, you said that you like to keep your characters in the same town. You don't want them going to different locations. I'm curious about why.
Oh, I mean, I think at the heart of it, it's that I'm a domestic writer. Like, my primary obsession is, like, how do you make a space that can hold you and that can hold the people that you love? And how can you make a space that will allow for people to leave but to also come in? And so that's kind of the reason I like doing it. But the other reason is maybe that I'm a lazy writer and I don't want to do too many locations because that gets stuck in my head. But then the other thing is, the more that you can keep the story constrained, a single town, a single home, the more possibility for tension and the more possibility for combustion and weirdness. You know, just like anything, if you put vegetables in a pickling jar and you keep it contained in there, weirdness happens. It transforms. And I do the same with my fiction. If I can hold everything in a tight space, when it finally opens up, it's changed.
Yeah, very well said. Yeah, that's great. Kevin Wilson, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today. Congratulations on Now Is Not the Time to Panic. I can't wait to read your next book.
Oh, thank you so much.
Kevin Wilson is the author of Now Is Not the Time to Panic. Don't panic! You can find out more at wpr.org/beta.